Well, the honeybee has been a source of fascination to humanity for thousands of years. There's a kind of miracle to a beehive, a complex social world populated by cold-blooded creatures who act as a living thermostat, maintaining the hive temperature at precisely 34 degrees while engaged in a precision honey-making enterprise that puts Henry Ford to shame. Well, pondering the mystery of the bee has preoccupied everyone from a Nobel Prize-winning scientist to the great characters of literature like, well, Winnie the Pooh, who was often found staging a poorly planned raid on a beehive. Christopher Robin, he would say, "I think the bees suspect something." "Yes, Pooh, perhaps they think you're after their honey." "Why?" "It may be that." "You can never tell with bees." Well, perhaps you can tell. If anyone knows what bees are about, it's Bruce White, my guest today. For 43 years, an apiaries officer in the Department of Primary Industries in New South Wales, he is an award-winning beekeeper who also teaches the mysteries of maintaining a healthy hive, and every year for more than 40 years, he's given service in a role that Winnie the Pooh would risk paw and snout for. He's a honey judge for the Royal Agricultural Society. Bruce White, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thanks very much, Ellen.
You're a fan of Winnie the Pooh?
I am.
Look, I dare say very few people are fascinated with, I don't know, fruit flies or flies generally, but bees captivate us. Why do you think?
Well, I think they captivate us, Ellen, because every season's different. They're such industrial insects. They produce many products, not only honey. And once people start to keep bees, they just can't become so intrigued and so devoted to bees. And, you know, there are more amateur beekeepers in Australia and particularly in New South Wales than there are commercial beekeepers because they're just so fascinated with what happens. You know, I first come across a beehive at a friend's I was at school with, and I'd sit for hours just sitting at the front of the beehive watching the bees come and go, collecting pollen, collecting water, collecting nectar. And they just intrigued me the way they work. They all cooperate together. And, you know, beekeepers are so passionate about the bees and the environment.
Mm. And there's a sort of powerful symbolism there. Maybe it's the feminist in me coming out, but there's the strong female, Bruce.
There
at
is.
The centre of this social enterprise, and then all these selfless drones who give their lives for the commune. It's a sort of a noble preoccupation, isn't it?
Very much so. I mean, the Queen, you know, is regarded as royalty, and she can lay twice her own weight in eggs a day. Twice her own weight in eggs a day, 2,500 eggs a day. And all the worker bees are actually females, are incomplete females, and a colony can be, you know, up to 100,000 individual females that do all the work, and the poor old drones are only there, you know, to reinvigorate the population by mating with the, queen bees. And, of course, noble people were the ones that really, you know, had bees in the early days, the aristocracy, you know, with the beekeepers of the towns way back in history.
And you were saying you first came across them as a boy. You grew up in the city, and back in those days, and even when I was young, people would keep bees routinely. It wasn't an unusual thing, was it?
No, it was not unusual. You know, a lot of people had beehives in their backyard and poultry and things like that. So that, you know, really started me off because I had a friend at school who had a beehive in his backyard. But even today, I mean, Ellen, there's a lot of people got bees, you know, in the city. You know, there's probably 1,500 people in Sydney, you know, that are actually, you know, got beehives in their backyards. You don't see them, they're hidden. But there's a real interest in beekeeping now, and there's been a new invention called the flow hive, and that'll create a lot more interest in beekeeping. And, you know, I do beekeeping courses, and next one I'm doing is for New South Wales DPI. It's been booked out. You know, various beekeeping associations do courses. So there's an enormous interest in beekeeping, and it's pleasing that, you know, people are trying to learn before they get a beehive. The worst thing you can do is get a beehive and not learn how to manage it, and it's critical that you do to learn that.
Well, let's look back from the beginning of your life with bees. You weren't a country kid. Where did you grow up?
No, I grew up in Wollongong, actually, in Mangaton, in a suburban backyard, went to Mount St Thomas Public School and Tech College in Wollongong. So I didn't have a rural background, but, you know, I became involved with junior farmers and that sort of helped my passion. My father came from Tilpa on the south coast. So he had some sort of farming, you know, background, and in the Depression, you know, he cut trees down, you know, for sleepers. So he'd come across bees in the bush. So, you know, my parents encouraged me to, you know, be interested in agriculture once I showed a passion, and I really appreciate that so much today. You know, that doesn't happen. And it was that early passion and support of my parents that actually led me, you know, into beekeeping and eventually, you know, to a job.
And so how did you pursue the interest? You come home from your friend's place and said, look, I haven't been staring at the telly. I haven't been playing Minecraft on a device. I've been staring at a beehive.
That's right. Those devices weren't very common in those days. I remember black and white television and no iPads or computers or anything like that. Yeah, so I'd come home and, yeah, pester my parents, said, you know, I think bees are great. And because my father had actually cut down trees, he wasn't frightened of bees. So eventually, you know, I guess I must have pestered him. And we had goats and we had chooks as well, because there were spare blocks around in Wollongong in those days. So eventually bought me a beehive. I became a member of Junior Farmers, which is now Rural Youth, and that was a fantastic organisation. And the supervisor at the time was Arthur Chalmers. And I went to Albion Park, which was more country than Wollongong, about, you know, 20-odd kilometres south. And eventually, you know, I did a vegetable growing project there because I was interested in vegetable as well. And then I did a state, you know, beekeeping project for junior farmers. And that really, you know, put me on the path to learn things, because that project had a lot of technical knowledge in it. So I was able to better manage hives. And my father, while he cut down trees, he didn't have a great knowledge of bees. But, you know, it was very supportive. But unfortunately, he passed away not long after we got the bees. You know, that's how it all happened. And, of course, my mother was also very supportive, even to the extent where I was allowed to put a beehive in the bedroom at one stage.
We'll come back to that. Did it become something of a father-son project? The putting of the beehive in the backyard and the gradual introduction to what you have to do in order to keep bees safely.
Yes, it did. And I mean, I was totally dependent on my parents to take me to junior farmers meetings, because I couldn't, you know, walk there. It was 20 kilometres or so away. So they were very supportive in that. And, you know, the junior farmer organisation in those days, you know, was very active and encouraged youth, you know, into farming and beekeeping enterprises. And interesting, they'd already written a project on beekeeping, and had projects on all sorts of things. So, you know, my passion in those days was bees and vegetable growing. You know, we'd go to Tapto Show, Albion Park Show, Kiama Show, Berry Show, Kangaroo Valley Show. You know, so I was able to put vegetables in the show, you know, honey in the shows where there was classes. And, you know, my thanks goes to that organisation for really, you know, giving me a lot more encouragement, because at school, you know, there's no agricultural topics as there is now in, you know, some of the high schools.
And do you remember the very first time with that first hive where you got honey from your own hive?
Yeah, it was great. You know, bees in backyards do pretty well, and you can get, you know, 30 kgs a year out of a hive. So
that's a lot of Weet-Bix, isn't it?
It is a lot of Weet-Bix. Yeah, so bees do really well because there's a good balance of food for them, both nectar and pollen. Yeah, so I remember that, you know, it was quite exciting. I think my father probably borrowed an extractor off someone. You need an extractor to get honey off. We spun the extractor around. I was the donkey engine turning the extractor. And, you know, it was great to get the first lot of honey. And, of course, that gave me, you know, a bit more encouragement. And then eventually we had a bit more than we needed to eat, so I could sort of sell a bit of honey and get a bit of pocket money.
This is all right.
So that was easy. Right. And I didn't have to do any work. I didn't have to feed them. Like, bees are one form of agriculture where there's certainly management and knowledge required, but you don't have to feed them every day like you do poultry or milk cows or anything like that. You don't need to own a lot of land. You can put bees on other people's land. So it was a really good enterprise that the bees did all the work, and I just had to take the honey and sell it.
So here you are going around to the Kiama show and all the rest of it with your veggies and your honey. But there's also such a thing as showing bees. I mean, you can show a bull or something like that. How do you show bees?
You can certainly show bees, Ellen. So there's classes at different shows, you know, for a queen bee and progeny. So a queen bee's got to be a certain shape, and the bigger she is and the more attractive she is, she gets more points. Honeybees mate, the queen mates on the wing with several drones, up to a dozen. So each beehive is a separate, the separate families in a hive. So if a queen bee mates with 10 drones, there's 10 families in the hive. She mates with six, there's six families in the hive.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're judging bees, you need uniform colour. So the less drones they mate with, the more uniform the worker bees are. So you've got to look at that. You can look at the pattern of the queen, the egg-laying ability of the queen. So specific points in shows for showing a queen bee and progeny, just as there's points for showing a show bull or a show sheep or whatever. So
that's fascinating.
It certainly is. It is fascinating.
I'm just sort of wondering that there's little kids out there listening, thinking, well, you know, you can call the dogs jumping, and maybe you could turn yourself into a bee caller, you know, on ABC Honey. And here we have the Queen coming out of the matchbox from young Bruce White.
Yeah, they're the only animal in the world you can post, actually, Ellen.
You can post the bee.
You can post a bee. So bees are imported from overseas through a quarantine station in Sydney. And when you buy a queen bee from someone in Queensland or South Australia or somewhere, it arrives in the post in a little box with a few worker bees and some food in it, and that's how you buy a new queen bee. And you can artificially inseminate queen bees to improve stock, so there's breeding programs. So it's a fairly sophisticated industry when you really get into it.
As we said, Bruce, bees and the making of honey was a connection from your young life with your father. And you lost your father at the age of 14. That's a critical year, if I can say, for a boy. You know, you're on the cusp of manhood, you're in the depths of adolescence, and you've got the remnants of childhood trailing by. What happened?
Yeah, it was a shock. He had a heart attack and suddenly passed away, so it wasn't totally expected. And my mother, did a great job. She couldn't drive a car at that stage. So she learned to drive a car to take myself and my sister around. She was a civilian widow. There wasn't a lot of finance in the family. So she used to take in boarders to supplement her income. And she was a wonderful lady to bring both my sister and myself up under, quite difficult, circumstances. I guess I was lucky. I always knew what I wanted to do. So I always had a goal, so that, drove me, as far as schoolwork goes, to achieve what I want to achieve, whereas a lot of people don't know what they want to do.
Mm.
So, I was fortunate that way.
And what did you do with the beehive that you and your father had cared for after he died?
So after he died, I was able to have enough knowledge by doing a junior farmer project to be able to increase hive numbers. So I was able to split the hive up and make more bees, and by doing that I had more hives so I could get more pocket money, from the hives in the backyard.
And what did the honey taste like?
So honey, in the backyard is mixed grill honey.
Mixed grill honey.
Mixed grill honey. Because there's so many plants flower, Ellen, in the city. So plants either yield nectar or only pollen, or they yield nothing, no reward for bees at all, like orchids. So in the city, bees get a whole variety of different types of honey, and the bees blend that and mix it in the hive. So, the honey extracted in the spring, the autumn, is totally different to honey each year because the same plants don't flower every year. And the spring honey is totally different taste to the autumn honey.
And did you know all this as a youngster?
No, not really. No, I didn't.
It's sticky and sweet and that'll do?
Yes. Whereas commercial beekeepers move where there's an abundance of the same plant flowering, and they get a distinct floral type of honey. So if you move to Yellow Box, you get Yellow Box honey. But in the city, it's hard to get a pure floral type from any one species.
Hmm. But meanwhile, before you know all of this, you're not only having them in the backyard, but as you said, you've brought it into the bedroom. Now, just logistics first. How do you get a beehive into the bedroom? Let's leave Mum's approval aside in just a moment. Poor woman.
Okay, well, the first thing, I had to cut a hole in the window.
Stop. you what?
Had to cut a hole in the window, because in those days we had, you know, glass windows with wooden frames around them. They're a bit different nowadays. So I was able to cut a hole in the wooden part of the bottom of the window, because the bees had to get out of the bedroom to go to work. So I convinced my mother I should be able to do that, so I was able to do that.
One friend down the road's got a doggy door on it.
Yeah, that's
right, a bee door under the window.
Yeah, so you need a bee door if you keep a beehive in your bedroom. So then I had a table up that was the right level. So then I was able to buy, you could buy a thing called an observation hive, so I was able to buy a bee box that had a glass sides in it and glass at each end. And a cover over it as well, so it was dark for the bees. So I bought that box. You can transfer bees from a normal box into that. So I did that. And then at night when all the bees are at home, I picked the box up and put it into the bedroom. And then, you know, climbed up a ladder on the outside because the house was up a bit off the ground and, opened the hive up so that the bees could then fly in and out of the window. So then at night, I could take the covers off and look through the glass and you'd see bees dancing, you'd see them, ripening their nectar. For daytime, you could see them unloading their pollen. You could see them unloading their nectar of a daytime. I could see the queen laying eggs. So it was really, really intriguing. And of course, the real interesting thing is if they get nectar through the day, they work all night and they've got to reduce that to make it into honey. So nectar comes from the flowers. It's a sucrose solution, mainly sugar. And as you mentioned in your introduction, it's 34 degrees in a beehive. So the bees pass that nectar. I could see them passing it from tongue to tongue and the hot air evaporating the moisture off it. And then when it got below 21%, they put a wax cap over it and then it became honey. So I could see all this, by watching at night and through the day. I guess they were a distraction to me. And, of course, if they got a lot of nectar, it was like an orchestra because they all fan to evaporate the moisture out of the nectar all night, a really audible, loud sound. So, I had the orchestra in bed at night when they were getting nectar. If they weren't getting any nectar, there was no noise. And that's how you can tell without opening a hive at night if bees are getting food in the form of nectar or they're not.
And what does that sound like?
Oh, it's a real roaring sound because the bees are all fanning. A beehive's completely air-conditioned, Ellen, so they suck air in one side, blow it out the other side, and their wings, they're stationary and their wings flap, and the flapping of the noise of the wings creates a sound like an orchestra.
Like a buzzing sound?
A buzzing sound as they ripen the nectar to get the nectar to honey. And then once it's under 21, it's honey, they stop fanning.
And is it a constant drone or does it crescendo?
Constant. And if the nectar's fairly thin, it's usually 70%, but sometimes it can be 80%. So they've got to get that down to 21. So they can sometimes make a noise right till daylight the next morning. If the nectar's thicker, say it's only 50% if you're a Tullamore or somewhere like that, they might only make a noise till midnight and then they'd stop. So I'd music in my bedroom when the bees were getting nectar. Now, they only usually get nectar, spring, summer and into autumn. In winter, there's not a lot of nectar, around Sydney coming in.
Your wonderful mother letting you do all this.
Yeah, she was. Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. But, it gave me encouragement and that's what I think's important. If I hadn't had that encouragement, I wouldn't have had a job in the Department of Agriculture. I probably wouldn't have an incentive to do all right at school because I knew what I wanted to do. I knew I had to, study, to get into the Department of Agriculture. So by her encouragement, it was great. And, I find now, some schools ask me to talk at schools, happy to do that, take bees along in a Perspect box. But other schools, you mention bees and they won't have anything to do with it because of OH&S and all those sorts of things, which I think is a bit sad, because children need exposure to all sorts of forms of things and that can lead to them, getting a career in something.
And you were dealing with the grief of your father, the whole household was. You said it was a sort of a distraction for you?
In hindsight, I guess it probably was. But I think, even if you'd still been there, I still would have had that same drive and passion because, he encouraged me as well. But, I guess in hindsight, I didn't think of that at the time. It probably was,
I'm always fascinated by city kids who grow up with the soul of a country kid. You were one of those and you ended up at Ag College, where you got the chance to study beekeeping in a more formal way. How much was there still to learn?
Oh, look, there's still a lot to learn. I'm still learning now. Like, bees are such intriguing things, and you're always, you know, continually learning about what they do, how they operate. You know, it's an ongoing thing to learn about bees. And you know, I've been fortunate in that I've had a lot of good teachers, a lot of beekeepers, you know, I've had contact with.
Was there a particular person at the Ag College who stood out for you?
Oh, yeah, Neville Cutts. Neville's still alive. And Neville was the lecturer in apiculture at Hawkesbury Ag College. Hawkesbury Ag College, you did general agriculture, about everything. And it was fairly hands-on and practical, you know, as well as theoretical. Mm. So beekeeping was only for the first year. So I studied that for the first year. And then the Department of Agriculture had a summer school in apiculture at Hawkesbury Agricultural College at that stage. They don't even teach agriculture now. So I was invited to the summer school, you know, when I was in second year, and in third year, for a whole week, Neville taught, you know, budding beekeepers how to keep bees. So I was really, really fortunate that, you know, Neville, you know, was so good to me to allow me to do that, because he could have picked anyone, because there was others a bit interested in bees. So he was really a great mentor. And then, you know, Alan Clemson, when I joined the Department of Agriculture, was a wonderful person. And, you know, I certainly learned a lot from him. Mm. And, you know, from other departmental officers, Fred Benneke, in particular, who was at Tamworth at the time. Yeah, so I had really good people in the department, you know, to teach me. And then, you know, when I actually, you know, eventually got into the department, a lot of beekeepers were really good to me too, to teach me about flora and management and all that sort of thing.
Mm. As you say, you finally went to work for the Department of Agriculture, and that was a trajectory you could see from the age of 12, which I think is interesting, that you could see how to turn a hobby and a passion into a life's work, which is a grand thing for a boy. Why does the government need bee experts?
Oh, I mean, I had a hiccup in the meantime, because I finished in 62 and there was a credit squeeze on, so I had to become a greenkeeper for 12 months. The industry, you know, needs people to teach them, because particularly in beekeeping, there's no other support except, you know, New South Wales agriculture. If you're a farmer, you know, you've got stock and station agents that you can go to. If you're a grain grower, you know, you've got agronomists that are private agronomists that can give you advice. But in beekeeping, there's no private supplier at all to the beekeeping industry except the government. You know, in its heyday, there were 9 apiary officers in the Department of Agriculture. Today, there are only 2. Now, because of cutbacks, and by the government, you know, having someone involved in beekeeping, beekeepers got the right technical information. And of course, we export a lot of honey, we export bees over the world, and a lot of countries require some government control over an industry to be able to export.
Mm.
And, you know, we need to export because we produce more honey than we eat here, and that honey needs to be sold. So as far as export goes, if the government's involved, we can say to other countries that want our products, there is some control over the industry.
Your work took you all over the state. By the time you got to Orange, you and your wife, Lynn, had 3 boys. Now, it strikes me, Bruce, that bees are very organised, responsible creatures.
Very much so.
You and Lynn sometimes struggled in that department. Just tell me briefly what happened when you packed up to leave Orange and had to head back to Sydney.
Okay, so, yeah, I was fortunate enough to, you know, get a promotion to Sydney. It took me 12 months to come, but anyway, eventually the decision was made to come to Sydney, and we ended up buying a house in Sydney, which was affordable in those days. You know, we packed up the car and a truck, so we loaded it all up. On the day we were ready to leave, the furniture van had come, took our, you know, furniture and all that sort of thing. And so out we go, out to the front, and we jump in the car. I think Lynn got in the car, I got in the truck, I was going to follow her. And then suddenly we realised, crikey, we've left one of the boys behind.
How far did you get?
Not very far.
And who'd you left behind?
Damien. So we'd left Damien, who was the youngest boy. All the 3 boys were born in Orange. And Damien was only 6 weeks old. And we put him in a bassinet, you know, in one of the rooms and thought, well, we'll get him later. And he was asleep, so there was no problem. So we jump in the vehicle, start to take off, and suddenly one of us, heck, we haven't got Damien. Because I think probably Lynn had one of the boys, I had the other one, and there's one missing. And the one that was missing, because should have been in the baby seat in Lynn's car. So he could have been left in Orange on his own. But anyhow, we did remember.
He's listening today. Has he heard that story before?
He has, yes. He's well aware of that. Yes, he certainly has.
Yeah.
You're listening to Conversations on ABC Radio. You can subscribe to our free podcast. Go to abc.net.au/conversations.
And Ellen Fanning sitting in for Richard Feidler. My guest is Bruce White, who's had a life enthralled to bees. He's been studying bees for about six decades. He's a former principal apiary officer of New South Wales. Bruce, I suppose everybody asks you this. Have you been stung much?
Occasionally you get stung, but bees don't normally attack people. But if you don't handle them properly, they're defending their colony. So they will sting. The real critical thing, Ellen, is that you've always got to scratch a bee sting out. Never, ever pull a bee sting out because it's got a sac on the end of it and you'll get the full dose of the venom. You pull a splinter out, never pull a bee sting out. That's
and what's the difference between pulling and scratching?
If you pull it out, there's a sac on the end of the sting and it's a bit like the end of a rubber water pistol with a rubber end on it. So if you squeeze it, you squeeze all the venom into your body. Mm. If you scratch it out, you break that sac where the venom is held and it doesn't go into your body. There's a nervous reaction that pumps that venom into your body once the bee has stung you. And, of course, once the bee stings you, the bee dies.
So if you scratch it out, you're just dissipating the venom across your skin rather than...
And you're breaking that sac so the sac can't push the venom into your skin.
Does it still hurt?
Oh, look, all bee stings hurt, and people are more sensitive than others. Now, some people are super sensitive to bee stings. They're a very small portion of the population, and they need an EpiPen or some type of treatment. And usually those people are often allergic to mosquito bites or other types of bites as well.
So we overplay in your mind, other than for those people with a genuine allergic reaction to it, you think we overplay this fear of bees?
I think so, yes. And, I mean, everyone will swell a bit. That's not an allergic reaction. An allergic reaction is when your tongue swells and you can't breathe properly. That's a true allergic reaction. Mm. I mean, I swell a little bit. Everyone swells a little bit where the sting, you know, enters your body. If it goes in soft tissue, it's far worse than in hard tissue. So stung on your hands is not as bad as if you're stung on your face or your nose.
So, I mean, despite the odd sting, working with bees would seem to afford one the prospect of a quiet, interesting life. So, I mean, it seems almost doubly shocking that you were involved in the worst rail disaster in Australian history. That was Granville, 1977. Tell me about the morning of the Granville train crash.
Okay, so the morning of the Granville train smash, I used to drive to Wentworthville railway station. I had a truck and a car and my wife, you know, had in-laws up, so she wanted to take them shopping in Parramatta. So I took the truck, which I normally don't do, and, you know, parked at Wentworthville railway station. And when I got to Parramatta, there was a lot of people standing on the platform. So being keen to get to work, you know, often used to change trains if there was people on the platform. I never worried about a timetable. So that morning I saw all these people on the platform, so I jumped off the train I was on, jumped on the one and got in the front of the fourth carriage.
Because it was a quieter train?
It was a quicker train. It only stopped Strathfield, you know, Central, maybe at Granville. But if I was on the other train, it stopped at many more stations, so it might have taken another, you know, 10 minutes to get to work. So by seeing people, I knew there was a fast train. I knew I'd get to work quicker. So that's why I changed trains, which was a fatal mistake. But anyway, it could have been. So I was keen to get to work. So off we went. And the train, you know, really stopped suddenly. And there were a couple of girls standing beside me. And I was standing between the toilets. It was one of those old wooden carriages. And I said to the two girls, you know, everything seems okay. The train stopped. And then, you know, after that, just went dark, and I thought, you know, another train's hit it. I've no idea, you know, what had really happened. But, you know, I now know after they dragged me out, you know, it was a bridge that fell, you know, on top of the train. And that had, you know, quite an effect on me.
So what happened straight after it went dark?
Well, straight after it went dark, I mean, the good thing from my point of view was that there was no moaning, there was no groaning. It was so horrendous, it was right down on the line. So people were either alive or not. Because it would have worried me if someone wanted help, and I mean, I couldn't help them, but they might have been close to me, and I don't know what happened to the girls. And there was a big girder come down beside me, and I just see out through a little hole, and someone, and I now presume it was Barry Gables, who was the first ambulance officer, you know, at the crash, and he was at Auburn, and they thought it might have been a hoax, but I've subsequently talked to him. So presumably he came under the bridge and would have to crawl in places. And said, if you're alive, yell out or number off. So I was able to say, well, yeah, I'm here.
And what condition were you in at that stage?
Oh, totally stuck. Because I thought, well, you know, can I get out? Can't I get out? No, I can't. I could move my arms. I could move my head. I didn't know I had a big cut in my head. That would have freaked me out if there was blood.
So it's completely dark?
Yeah, completely dark in a little hole.
And you're trapped. You can't
trapped.
Move.
So I couldn't get my leg. My legs were jammed. I couldn't get my legs out. So I thought, well, I'll just have to wait and see what happens. And then I heard a whole heap of sirens, and that was probably good news. So then eventually, you know, I was able to talk to people. They couldn't see me. So I could talk to people that were outside who were, you know, obviously police rescue or ambulance officers or volunteers. Then over a period of time, and it took 3 hours because they put a number on your chest when you got out, so I could relate that back, you know, after a while. So eventually they cut and blunt sores because there was gas on the train. I couldn't smell any gas. A lot of people died with gas because it ruptured the gas cylinders because it was a steam, you know, wooden carriages with gas heaters in it.
So what were they using to try and cut you out?
Hand saws, because they couldn't use power tools. Like the rescuers at those stages, you know, wanted power tools. They had all the power tools, but they couldn't use them because of the gas, because it'd spark and create a fire, which I wasn't aware of. So they must have gone to different places, got all these blunt saws. But the wood would have been hard, like it was hard wood. So then eventually they could see me, and then they passed car jacks to me. So by passing car jacks to me, because my hands were free, I could put the car jacks in much further where my legs were jammed and, you know, slowly jack the wood up. And I did that slowly, which now I know I should have done slowly because if it's too quick, you can die. So a couple of car jacks and I kept jacking, shifting.
So you were being asked to assist in your own rescue.
Oh, yeah,
stage.
Because in those days, rescuers were big people, you know. They wanted big people to rescue. There weren't many small people. I mean, that was one of the lessons of Granville. They need big and well as small people in rescue. So small people can get in small cracks and crevices, whereas big people can't.
So you had these big rescuers passing your car jacks saying, jam that under the girder that's trapping you.
No, it was more the wood than the girder. The girder was beside me. It was a big steel girder. That gave me space. But the wood from the carriage that had been splintered, held my legs in place. So I slowly did it with car jacks. They didn't ask me to do that, just asked Jack. So once I could feel that I could shift my leg, you know, I was able to say, well, I can now shift, you know, it's now free. So then they just pulled me out of the hole, you know, put me on a stretcher, you know, face down, and then carried me to an ambulance. They had all the roads blocked off. The ambulance went straight to Parramatta Hospital where, you know, you were assessed. I knew I couldn't walk. And at the hospital, they had nurses from everywhere. There was just heaps of nurses there because they were worried about shock just to talk to you. I wanted to get a paper. Wouldn't let me get a paper.
A newspaper?
A newspaper, because I wanted to see what happened. Anyhow, because they had afternoon newspapers in those days. So eventually I convinced someone to get me a paper. So once I got a paper, I mean, you could I didn't realise the bridge fell down. Yeah, I didn't know what had happened. So by getting a paper, I mean, I could see the extent of the impact of the horrendous crash. You know, it was a fantastic rescue operation. Anyway, because I couldn't walk, I got an orthopaedic surgeon, John Harrison, who I've kept in contact to this day. I virtually ignored everything with Granville. I never went to any reunions, never went to anything until a few years ago when I went to one. I don't know why I didn't. And then I've subsequently been to a second one. I've subsequently met Barry Gables, who'd written the book. I've subsequently met Gary Raymond, who was second in charge of the police rescue squad. Next couple of weeks, I'm going to meet one of the ambulance men who carried me out on a stretcher because I got his photo, and Barry Gables has recognised him. Ronald Craig, his name is. I've never met him. So, yeah, I've now become a bit more involved.
And what did all that bring back for you? If you put it aside all those years, what emotional impact had it had at the time, and now that you're coming to shake hands with the
people? So the emotional impact was, you know, I was horribly jumpy because that bridge must have made an enormous noise, but I don't recall. I'd never remember the bridge falling down, but a car would blow its horn, any noise, I would jump. Really frightened the noises for quite a long time. It taught me that, you know, life can be so short with no fault of your own. So we didn't have a colour TV at the time, I don't think, so I went and bought a colour TV. I was off work for 6 months because I couldn't walk. But by the same token, I mean, I always talked about it to people. I always knew I was going to get better, but I was a bit shocked because I went up to Castle Hill one day and you know, the don't walk on the walk signs, and I thought I was going great. I mean, I still had my calipers, but I could walk. I got rid of my crutches, and I thought, oh, I'm going really well. I could hardly get across the, you know, quarter of the way across the road, and the light changed, don't walk, so I realised I was mighty slow.
How much damage had you done to your legs?
What happened was, because they were crushed, it damages the nerves. Because the nerves were damaged, they didn't know if the nerves had grown to the wrong ends. So about the second day, they put me in an ambulance and took me to Royal Prince Alfred, I think. They put all these electric wires on me, horrible. And then they put charges of electricity through my body, and that told them that my nerves were okay because my foot dropped, I couldn't walk. But they knew they hadn't been severed. If they'd been severed, they'd have to do microsurgery to put the nerves into the right ends. You know, John Harrison only, you know, probably a year ago said, you know, I probably had a lot of broken bones, but they didn't have the technology in those days to know. So because the nerves were so badly squashed, they wouldn't communicate with my muscles, so my muscles wouldn't work. So the therapy was to get into water and have water moving over my legs, which massaged my nerves. I'm not a medico, I hope I'm saying this right. So the nerves were massaged, and then eventually, you know, I could start to walk properly. But, you know, it took 6 months for me to be able to, you know, walk properly. But I was determined I was going to walk, and that was the effect. You know, jumpiness, life can be short without any, you know, fault of your own. And to recover, you know, you really need a positive outlook to beat whatever the problem is.
Did you ever find out what happened to those couple of women you were talking to?
No, I don't. But Barry seems to think he might know their names. The guy that's written the book, he's done a, you know, fantastic job. And he thinks they were two sisters that got on the train and sadly, you know, passed away. Yeah, because there are only, I think, 12 people that survived under the bridge. So, I don't know what, 83, 84 were killed. So, I mean, I'm mighty lucky. But because I was standing between the toilets, I think that probably helped because it was stronger. And the fact that this huge girder come down, like if I'd put my arm out, I would have lost my arm, but it just fell beside my body just through sheer luck. I mean, you had no say in it. And ironically, when I ended up in hospital, there was two to a room, and the other person was the son of a beekeeper. Amazing. And the side of the bridge had fell through the roof of the third carriage, and he was, you know, had far more serious injuries than I think I had. Yeah, so how ironical to end up with a beekeeper. His father was a fireman, you know, so we met in hospital. Yeah, amazing.
How did your wife find out what would happen?
Oh, well, she didn't know. She was in Parramatta shopping. You know, there was people walking around in a daze in the shops. And she said, yeah, what's going on? And they said, oh, it's been a major train accident. And they were appealing for everyone to donate blood, you know, immediately. So she said, oh, you know, my husband can't be on that train. Anyway, when she got home, obviously the neighbour, the police had been, clergy, everyone had been to say, you know, get to Parramatta Hospital as quick as you can. So as soon as she found that out, she took off to Parramatta Hospital. There was a policeman out the front, and he said, what are you doing? I said, see my husband, I don't know what's happened. He said, oh, he'll be all right. So then she came up and saw me, and that policeman was there when she left, you know, which she really appreciated. That happening.
That he'd started.
So that's
there.
How she found out, yeah. And I had a bandage on my head and couldn't walk, but you know, and like the middle son, Matthew, it really affected him. The other two boys weren't quite as bad because they were at school and, yeah. But anyway, I was always going to survive.
And why do you think it hit Matthew so hard?
Oh, he's probably more emotional than the other two boys. And I think there was someone in his class that had either been killed or was involved in the accident as well. And there was someone in DPI, you know, Department of Ag at the time, that was killed too, an agronomist that I didn't know was on the same train.
And, I mean, other than buying the colour telly, what did it tell you about life and how to view life? When that
well, every day is a bonus now. Like every day is a bonus. You know, I well could have been killed in 1977. I mean, it was just some, you know, act of fate or something that I survived. So now, you know, every day is a bonus. You know, I try to live every day to the fullest. I probably take on too much work, even though I've retired. I'm still really active, which is probably good. So it taught me how short life can be. Yeah, and how fortunate I am to, you know, be able to still be here. And there was no fault of the train driver or anything. I mean, it was just lazy maintenance. The sleepers were rotten. That logo was the heaviest logo on the line. And the weight of it split the sleepers. There were also deficiencies in the maintenance of the loco. So really it was just, you know, very poor maintenance of the line and the loco at the time that caused that accident to happen. And it was just unfortunate. That type of bridge wasn't a span bridge. Had staunchions. The staunchions got took out. And that forced the bridge to come down. You know, there's cars on the bridge and all sorts of things when it come down.
So it's logical, and there's no one to blame, and there's a logic to it, and there's a life lesson in it for you.
Yes, yes.
It took me a while to establish, Bruce, that you were in fact retired, because I'm not sure what the difference is between your life being retired and not in terms of the work you do. Now, you're involved with Bees in the City. They call you the Bee Whisperer on the website. Why encourage people in the city to keep bees?
Well, bees are the, you know, foundation of agriculture, and without bees to pollinate crops, you know, 2/3 of all the food we eat, you know, comes from honeybees. You know, in the city, I guess there's less now than what there used to be, but they're, you know, a lot of backyard gardens, and bees, you know, can be encouraged to pollinate gardens. And people can get, you know, a lot of satisfaction out of keeping a beehive because every year is different. The honey flavours are different. You don't have to feed them, but you certainly need knowledge, and you should join, you know, an Amateur Beekeeping Association or the New South Wales Apiarist Association to learn about bees. So with Kate Burton, who's a candle maker, we decided to become involved with Bees in the City. So there's bees on, you know, restaurants and on verandas of houses.
And you actually coach people in how to be
so
a beekeeper.
Encourage them to learn properly. That's part of it. They don't just get a hive. They get, you know, taught how to keep a hive as well. You've got to be careful, Ellen, that you put them in the right location because bees will fly to lights at night. You know, there's certain places in the city where you wouldn't want to keep bees. The people who've got bees in the backyard, you know, it's rewarding. They get 30 kilos of honey a year or more or a bit less depending on what flowers. Yeah, it's amazing how well bees do in the city. It surprised me.
What do they eat? I mean,
well, there's jacarandas around. There's bilberry tea tree. There's brush box. There's various, you know, eucalypts around, black butts and bloodwoods and things like that. It surprised me, you know, because we had a port surveillance program in the Department of Ag to check for monitoring for exotic parasites at, you know, ports. And those bees were owned by private people. I used to manage them for them. And they were used to getting a lot of honey too, you know, at Balmain, at other, you know, port locations around Sydney.
And so how popular is it? How many hives in I don't know, Sydney would have?
It's probably, you know, 1,500 beekeepers registered with the Department of Agriculture. If you keep a beehive, you're required to register them. In case we get exotic pests and parasites, we can track them down and do something about it. So something like 1,500 people got bees in the backyards in Sydney. And usually we say get two hives, not one, because it makes management easier that one can help the other.
And how do you get started?
Well, you get started, there's several ways. You can catch a swarm.
There's
a lot of swarms around.
How do you catch a swarm? Don't say that.
Quite easy. So they hang on a bush. So what happens when a hive swarms? The cavity gets too small, basically. The old queen leaves with half the bees. The cluster hangs on a tree. Bees are do different jobs depending on the need of the colony. So bees go out, it's called scout bees. They look for all the hives and cavities around the place, and then the whole lot takes up residence there. But you can catch them before that. So the amateur beekeepers have got a hotline where if there's a swarm of bees, someone gets a swarm, they can ring them up, the police, councils and that. So you just need to take your box along, put them in your box, and wait till night and shut the box in and take it home. So you can do that. You can buy bees by the kilo. It's 10,000 bees to a kilo.
How many bees to a kilo?
10,000 bees to a kilo.
How much is a kilo of bees? How much money?
Oh, how much money? Okay, so they're about $120 to buy 10,000 bees. So you don't count them, you weigh them. You can buy what we call a nucleus colony, which is a small hive, which is probably, you know, about $100, $120, $130 to start off. Or you can buy an established hive that's already going and they're about $200, $250. You know, put that in your backyard. But, you know, learn about bees before you start to do that.
And what about honey? Different sorts of honey. Give us a quick education in the different sorts of honey available.
Okay, so bees go to a flower. They suck up the sucrose from the nectaries of flowers. And each particular species produces a different coloured honey. And there's a French machine that measures the colour of honey. And it also produces a different flavoured honey. So if bees went to a brush box tree, the flavour of that honey would be totally different if they went to a clover plant. So we can type honey by taste. As you mentioned, I judge honey, so I can tell what clover honey tastes like, what brush box honey tastes like, but they're both light coloured honeys. But if you go to stringy bark, I mean, stringy bark's a strong flavoured honey, and it's a darker coloured honey. Beekeepers sell honey by colour, so the lighter honey, the more they get when they sell to a honey packer. So honey's got, you know, enormous amount of varieties of flavour. So if you've got a hive in the backyard, you get honey in the spring different to the autumn. You can keep those two batches separate. It's going to taste different. Or you can mix them together. So honey will mix together. So you just mix it together, warm it up and mix it together, and you get a different flavour again because you've got the mix of the two. So there's quite an art in, you know, blending honey, and most honey sold by supermarkets is by honey packers in supermarkets is normal honey, but it's blended, it's mixed the different flavours together. So people become real connoisseurs of honey, and in some supermarkets you can buy leatherwood, which is a rainforest tree in Tasmania, flowers every year, you know, really distinct, strong flavour. Clover's lighter, iron bark, yellow box. So it's all different. And a lot of people don't realise that, Ellen, the different flavours of honey.
So now we're sort of into wine tasting territory. And
very much so, yeah, very much so.
Similar?
Similar, yeah, very similar.
And yes. How long did it take you to develop a palate that could distinguish?
Oh, it takes a while. Like, you've got some that are distinct flavours. Like, anyone who's tasted leatherwood from Tasmania is very, very obvious. Stringy bark's very, very obvious. But others, you know, aren't as obvious. Like, you know, Salvation Jane, Patterson's Curse is not that different to what clover is. They're both, you know, sweet types of honey. So, you know, type honey by the taste. But there's going to be a few other things in it sometimes.
And is Australian honey a particular flavour that Australians like? Is there a sort of a Vegemite quality to it that you've got to be born
in? Yeah, I guess there is. You know, people know about yellow box. You know, they know about iron barks. So the most common trees that people associate with honey is yellow box, iron bark, you know, stringy bark. If you're in Tasmania, you know, it's all leatherwood. Seems to be what you're brought up with is the flavour you like. And, of course, the European population that's here don't like eucalypt honey particularly. So they'd sooner go for clovers and canola and ground floor crops because that's what they've been used to, you know, in that part of the world. So Tasmania's leatherwood, Europeans, you know, other non-eucalypt types of honey.
And just finally, you know, sometimes you see these fictionalised Armageddon stories, human life wiped out after the sudden death of all bees. That likely?
It is, Ellen. You know, when you think about it, honeybees are the foundation of agriculture, and that's not really appreciated by farmers, by governments. If there were no bees, it would be very difficult, you know, for us to live because two-thirds of all the food we eat is pollinated by honeybees. To give an example, I put bees in cucumbers for seed and they put polycarbonate cover on it, and that cuts out ultraviolet light, bees need ultraviolet light to see, so the bees couldn't see. If I put bees in normal igloos with normal plastic on them, they're getting 10 cucumbers per plant for seed, which they export. Mm. Where that happened, they had to hand pollinate the plants and they got 2 cucumbers per plant.
Why?
So, you know, bees are essential for pollination. Well over 100,000 hives go to almonds, you know, to pollinate almonds. Kiwi fruits, cucurbits, you know, they've got distinct male and female flowers, so there needs to be a vector to transfer the pollen from the male part to the female part. And honeybees on the same field trip go to the same species of plant. So they're the unsung heroes of feeding the nation.
Well, it's a lovely note on which to end. Thank you so much. I can now fully understand your fascination, a life spent in bees. Thank you so much for being my guest.
Thanks very much, Ellen.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.